came. He had two black eyes and a plaster cast on his arm. He was limping, but he was grinning like a lighthouse. Johnny wasted no time. "Dwight, collect 2 1,000-foot rolls of blast cord, about 3 100-pound drums of liquid explosive, 3 of those port-a-pack drill rigs with 100 feet of shaft for each, and fuses and things."
"What are you going to do?" asked Thor. "Blow up the planet?"
Johnny said, "You, Thor, collect every man here we had with us at the load and a lot of Chinese." Stormalong was there. "Get ready to transport explosives and men across that lake," Johnny told him. "The instant they are through with this first hour's firing, we've got to be ready to roll." He scribbled a note for a communicator to give to Angus the instant he was finished with firing boxes. "You are going to lose all power for 2 hours. Inform us when you are through with this first run, as we'll be running motors and blasting. Don't start firing again until you get an all clear from us. Communicate with me by mine radio." Men were being sent through the passage to the outside. Some of them were veterans from the raid and hospital cases. Dr. Allen looked on with disapproval, especially at Johnny, but he said nothing. Johnny got outside. It was daylight now, thank heaven. He could see what he was doing. He looked at the dam. Yes, indeed. Silt. There was silt splattered all over the place. What a muddy job this would be. Where the top of the dam had been broken, piles of silt lay there. There was silt all up the cliff sides, splattered as if with a gigantic paintbrush. Wet silt. One of the biggest dangers here was slipping and sliding. He had his mine radio on, so he could be told when they were done with the first hour's firing. Men were running dollies out of deep magazines, getting explosives to a plane. Pilots were standing by. 2 mine passenger planes were loading personnel. 12 Chinese raced into the powerhouse equipped with big wrenches. They would need them to move levers and controls frozen in place for 1,000 years. Johnny walked to the dam edge and looked up the lake. He couldn't believe his eyes. He would have thought the plunge through the atmosphere would have destroyed more of it than that. There was the capital ship, a gigantic wreck, dug sideways into the silt 5 miles up lake from the dam. And it was contributing its share to the disaster. The twisted, charred hulk was blocking fresh water flow to the dam. Above it, a new lake was forming. He got Dwight. "You pick about 3 men, put them on a flying platform, lay blast cord on the east side of that wreck, and blow a new water channel around it. I'll give you the time to fire the cord. Get it laid and come back to me." Dwight rushed off to find his men and more explosives. Johnny walked over to a point where he could see the opposite end of the dam. It was a very curved dam, its lakeside jutting into the lake like a half moon. Yes, there sure was water escaping. Because of the shape of the dam, a hard push of concussion against it would cause the ends to thrust much more strongly into the banks. The far end over there was firm enough against the cliff, but the bottom of the dam must have moved. Water was roaring out under that far edge like a gigantic fire hose. Possibly ancient cracks at the far base had been filled with silt until now, but the blast had torn them open. The only thing that would plug that was about 500,000 tons of rock dumped upstream from it. And this was no time to be dumping rock with blade scrapers and cranes. The half-formed plan he had made had been right. He looked at the cliffs on the far side of the gorge. If he blew one of them down to fill the breach, would the concussion also rip out the rest of the dam? The defense cable also ran along those cliffs. He did not dare sacrifice that, too. Angus's voice on the mine radio.
"First stage of firing is complete. Ready to shut down?"
"Shut down," said Johnny into his mine radio. "Powerhouse, take the power off. Storm along, fly them." The sizzle of the armor cable vanished. There was a patter of burst shell fragments, dead birds, and leaves, and they dropped to the ground, no longer held there by the ionization armor. The planes took off with a blasting roar. Johnny had spotted an unused flying platform, and he stepped aboard and hit the console. He went streaking out over the dam and lake, heading for the tops of the far cliffs. Dwight was there. Johnny eyed the texture of the rock in the cliffs. He estimated the rush and flow of water which must be occurring at this side bottom of the lake. His task was to dump enough rock off these cliffs into the lake and get it carried into that break to plug it. A tricky calculation. 3 holes. He needed to drill 3 holes, each about 100 feet deep and each at an exact angle. These would be at the points where the cliff must be sheared off. He pointed, raced along back of the cliff edge. 1, 2, 3. About 200 yards up lake from the dam. Down at an angle of about 15 degrees from the vertical. Men got the port-a-pack drills in operation. They were usually used to deep core a vein. But they could drill a fast hole. Fast enough? He only had 2 hours. The cable. This section lay closer to the lake than they were drilling. He mustn't sacrifice it. If left where it was, it would get severed by any blast and slide into the lake. "Storm along!" yelled Johnny. The pilot had just climbed out of a mine passenger plane. "What's the biggest motor we've got here now?" Stormalong looked at the planes. They had brought over 4. One was a marine attack plane. Stormalong pointed at it. "Get some technicians down to this end of the dam. There's a cable junction box there, according to this old defense map. Get them to unhook it. And then you put a heavy line on that end and fly this whole section of it out of the ground and dump it up there." This was right where Stormalong lived. What a crazy idea. To take the unfastened cable end and secure it to a plane and fly the plane southwest up the lake and tear the cable out. He needed no further instructions. He knew the weight of 1/10 of a mile of cable might well crash the plane. He'd put a quick release trip on it. He sent technicians racing to disconnect the dam end of it. Johnny looked at the drills. There were armored bits, and they could stand an awful lot of heat, but they were smoking. How fast could they drill? He looked at his watch and saw how many sections they were down already. This was going to be close. Up the lake, 5 miles away, the old mine hand that Dwight had sent and 2 assistants were sliding and slithering around in the silt beside the battleship wreck. They were sinking almost to their hips. The flying platform they had taken had to be reflown by its operator every few minutes to prevent it from simply sinking out of sight in the ooze. What a gigantic wreck. No wonder they couldn't put those down in atmosphere. They must assemble them on that moon, Asart, above Tallnap. Probably they flew the pieces up there section by section. Only intricate calculations of planetary gravity and gravitic force flows would let those things fly at all. He wondered for a sad moment whether Glenn Cannon's body was in there somewhere. But even a Mark 32 couldn't stand up to that internal blast. That ship was really a graveyard. There must be charred chunks of 1,500 Tallnaps in that twisted, blackened wreck. How long was it? 2,000 feet? 3,000? Hard to tell from here, so much was buried. But it was sure making a great dam. One would have thought it would have buried itself deeper. Then he saw what really was the case. It had made a sort of crater, and it was the crater edge that was restraining the water. He took a small scope from his pocket to see exactly what the men were doing. Yes, they were doubling up blast cord over the far crater edge, and then another one of them was doing the same thing on the near crater edge. They needed no advice. The drills were screaming through the rock, steam shooting up from their overheated water coolant jets. 20 men were rigging a line from the lake water to a mine pump. They were getting more cooling water. Ow, the silt! It was hard to walk without sliding, and nearly all the crews by now were caked with mud. He looked at his watch. It would be very touch and go. To drill 100 feet of hole in 3 hours would be a bit of a feat. They had to do it in about 1.5. They were really leaning on those drills. 4 men on each were adding their weight to the handles. He hoped that flashing signal on the small gray man's ship would hold good. They had skeletonized their defense force to handle this dam, and they were wide open to attack with no cable armor. his mind radio came alive. It was the party at the wreck calling Dwight. They were ready to fire. Dwight looked over to Johnny. With his scope, Johnny tried to see the generator intake ports in the dam. Were they closed? Muddy, muddy water. He couldn't see from here. He called the Chinese engineers inside the dam. Chief Chang Wan was in there.
"It needs 5 minutes to close the last port,"
the chief's voice came back.
"They've got the excess spillway ports closed." "I am sorry, Lord Johnny. I don't think these levers and wheels have been moved for years."
"Make it 1,000, said Johnny. "How many men have you got in there?"
72, said the chief.
Good Lord, he had half his force inside that dam. "You're doing great. Finish it up and then get everyone out of there. That dam could go, the whole thing, with these blasts."
"We'll hurry," said the chief.
There was a roar, and Stormalong took up slack on the defense cable. He was using his plane's bullhorns.
"Ready to rip,"
he yelled. "Tell me when everyone is clear." The big marine attack plane was hanging in the air at the dam end. Grapnels had the cable, and it was loose from the junction box. Men were scrambling away there. Johnny yelled to the men on the portapacks, "Stand clear." Unwilling to leave their drills, they nevertheless shut them off and went slipping and sliding away from the cliff edge. Johnny checked it. They were in the clear all along what must be the cable path.
"Let her rip,"
he yelled into his mind radio. In the plane, Stormalong poured it on. The cable, like a gigantic snake, jerking and resisting, began to come out of the ground. It was stalling the plane. Stormalong began to dance the huge ship up and down, yanking at the cable. Foot by foot and yard by yard, it worked free of the ground. The plane rose higher and higher, working along the cliff edge. He had almost half of it out of the ground. There was a ripping pop. The cable parted. Stormalong's ship catapulted toward the sky, trailing 200 yards of cable. He checked the rise. That Stormalong could fly. He took the broken piece up the lake and laid it on the shore. He triggered his quick release and dropped it. Stormalong came back overhead. Someone in the plane was lowering the grapnels.
"Hook me up,"
yelled Stormalong through the bullhorn above. Men went slithering down to the cliff edge. They caught the grapnel and got it securely fastened to the torn cable end. It could be patched, but all this was taking time and the drill crews weren't drilling. They got it fastened again, and once more Stormalong was pulling the remaining length from the bed in which it had rested for centuries. He got it free of the blast area and dropped it. The men raced back to their drills.
"We're all finished here,"
came Chief Chang Wan's voice on the mine radio.
"Excellent," said Johnny.
"Now clear every man out of there and tell me when they're gone, including you." He could see them streaming out of the powerhouse and up the far roadway, tiny figures in blue work clothes. At last, they were safely away from the dam.
"All clear, Lord Johnny," said Chief Chang Wan.
It wouldn't stop the drilling. Johnny signaled Dwight. Dwight gave the crew at the wreck their orders.
"Fire in the hole,"
yelled Dwight. Johnny could see them setting fuses. Then they slipped and slithered and plowed through the ooze to their flying platform and boarded it. They had to bodily haul the last one onto it by his collar and fly off with his legs still dangling. The platform went over to a safe area and landed. Johnny watched the wreck area.
Blowy, blowy!
The sharp cracks of blast cord exploding. A long line of mud catapulted into the sky. Smoke and spattering goo obscured the wreck for a moment. A shock wave made the ground tremble. A small roll of water ran down the lake. 24 seconds after the blast, the sound of it reached them like a hard buffet with a big hand. The smoke was clearing away up there. The enormous wreck had not moved, but a channel had been cut through the upper and lower crater edges. A trickle of water started through the farther one. Just a trickle? Johnny held his breath, eyeing it with a scope, afraid that, in their shortness of time, they would have to shoot again. Come on, he was saying. More, more. He knew water was very erosive and tended to chew and widen its own way. Come on. The farther side was at least 2 feet higher than the lake at the dam. It should have more push than that. Right then, some object in the way of the flow was worked out by the water. It was a big blast gun. It twisted in the swirl and then at last went tumbling away. The water burst through the far crater wall. It swirled and surged in the crater, a boiling, frothing churn of discolored mud. Water thrust the upper channel wider. More water burst through. Now it was working at the nearest ditch the blast cord had dug. It gnawed at obstruction and debris. And then it started through. A third surge in the upper crater. Pieces were tearing loose. There was a roaring torrent there now. The bowl was filling. It was emptying into the lower lake. They had gotten the river running again. Johnny told Dwight to give them a very well done. The drills were raving and smoking. Johnny looked at his watch. They only had about 20 minutes left. Where had the time gone? How many drill sections have you gotten into those holes? Asked Johnny to Thor. 5. That's 75 feet. It will have to be enough. Get those drills out of there. Storm along, he barked into his radio. Start pulling these crews and equipment out of here. He could see Chief Chong Wan, a speck way over on the far side. He spoke into his mind radio. Chief, you are going to see one awful flash over here in a few minutes. Wait to make sure the whole dam doesn't go out, and the instant it's safe, send a picked crew in there to open 2 generator ports and get the power back on to the cone cable and pagoda area only. Got it?
Yes, Lord Johnny.
And be sure to be under cover for this blast, added Johnny. They had the portapacks out and were clattering them in plain holds. Dwight, said Johnny, take those 3 drums of liquid explosive and pour them in those holes and then set the empty drums on top of them. Fast. Dwight pointed with his good arm and got men running. They began to pour a big drum of explosive into each hole. The holes were still so hot, the explosive was almost boiling. It was hard to get it to flow down against the trapped air. The air came bubbling and steaming back up. Johnny raced along, stringing blast cord. He put a big loop of it around each place where they would set a drum. The drums would be like bombs with the explosive vapor still in them.
Fuses! Yelled Dwight.
We've got no time, shouted Johnny. I'm going to set this off with the plane's guns.
What?
Gawked Thor. They had the barrels empty and were putting them in place in the circle of blast cord at each hole. A shot into any one drum would set off the lot.
Leave me that plane,
Johnny pointed at a single battle plane they'd brought.
Get the rest of them out of here with all men right now.
Stormalong started to protest and then started hurrying men into the remaining ships. As their equipment went slamming into the planes, Stormalong yelled over to Johnny,
Shoot it from way up! This thing is going to skyrocket!
Johnny was looking at his watch. They only had 9 minutes left. The planes were taking off. Dwight was being dragged into the last one. Johnny looked at this setup. All okay. He rushed to the battle plane and got ready to start it. There was nobody left in the area. He took off. He jumped the ship to about 2,000 feet. The dam still looked big. The planes were landing in sandbag abutments on the other side. Stormalong had really gotten across and slammed them down in an awful hurry. Chief Chong Wan and his men were under cover.
Fire in the hole, said Johnny on his mine radio.
He flipped the guns to flame, narrow, and maximum. He checked his security belt. Now for some nice gunnery. At this moment, it all looked pretty peaceful down there. The blackened wreck was spilling flotsam as water went through its broken girders. The river was flowing right up to the dam lake. But the increased water was spilling under the dam below the lake, and it would be tearing that hole wider and wider. Johnny closed all windows with a flick of switches, made sure all doors were secure. Should he back up to 3,000? No. This was the best range. A battle plane could take a lot. but he had never heard of anybody setting off 150 gallons of liquid explosive before, plus 1,000 feet of number 5 blast cord. He put his sights carefully on the center barrel. He pushed the gun trip. There was a flash across the whole sky before him, a curtain of green fire 3,000 feet high. Crash! The recoil hit him, and the plane went spinning skyward like a thrown toy. The yank of the security belt was like a blow. It knocked the wind out of him. 3 seconds later, he found he was upside down. He punched the console. The plane's balance motors caught up and righted it. He was flying backward. The whine of engines fought against the wrong direction. The plane steadied. Somebody would have to replace the windscreen. It had a diagonal crack in it. And then he saw the cliff. The smoke had cleared, and the whole cliff front was sliding down toward the lake in slow, slow motion. 500,000 cubic yards of rock moving down. A lot of it was apparently still in one piece, but that was an illusion. It was a clean slice of cliff, knifed off neatly. But inside it, the rock was cracked and shattered, and just before it hit the water, it lost shape and tumbled into fragments. It had looked at first like it hadn't left the bank, but there had been distance. Some of it struck nearly at the center of the lake. He watched the dam. Would it, too, crumble in slow motion, and this whole lake go roaring down the gorge? He had set it up so the shock wave would go into the air, not down through the ground. It had gone into the air, all right. Witness what happened to his plane. The first wave hit the dam, and a splatter of water soared 100 feet above the dam top. Had he lost too much water there? No, that was just spray. Was the dam holding? He could not tell whether the underwater currents were carrying the rock into the low hole. He darted the plane sideways. Water was still roaring out under the dam. He watched. Was it his imagination that it was lessening? His attention was yanked off it by blue figures racing down to the powerhouse. They certainly had not waited. He looked at his watch. He had only 2 minutes to get this plane out of the air. With a pound on the console keys, Johnny lanced the plane down to an empty abutment. He killed its motor. He had to make sure it was off. His ears were ringing. 33 seconds left to go. That was cutting it close. He went through the underground passage into the cone. He looked at the pagoda. Not even a tile had moved in that blast. Angus was at the console. The small gray man at the computer. Angus waved and shouted. Power's on! We're firing! 4. Somebody else had been busy in the last 2 hours. A different music was playing. It was very noble and dignified. It sounded vaguely familiar to Johnny, and then he remembered that a cadet had found a pile of what he called records, big things. If you ran a rose thorn held in a paper box around an endless circular groove and put your ear close, it sounded like 20 or 30 instruments playing. The ancient label on the record, mostly faded out, said the name of the piece was the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra, Lohengrin. This music was much like that, but deeper, fuller, quite impressive. Johnny suspected the small gray man had had a hand in that. Something from his ship? Music for the delegates to arrive by, of course. And something else that must be from the small gray man's ship. There was a screen, meshed so you could see through it, all around the firing platform, and Dr. Allen was finishing putting it up. Disease control, he said cryptically as Johnny passed by. Sweaty Chinese engineers crawled out of a duct hole with cheery faces. They had air circulating in and out now. The smoke had already cleared away. A good thing, thought Johnny. A lot of different atmospheres would momentarily be whiffing across the platform at the instant of coincidence of spaces and during recoil especially. And the mobs of Chinese refugees from the village had changed, too. They may have lost their village, but they had saved their possessions, and these had been scattered about. Now the untidy bundles had vanished. Children and dogs were quiet down in the rifle pits, and parents and others that had no immediate duties were standing about. They had on what must be their best clothes. An honor guard came out of a bunker and finished neatening themselves up with a tug here and a buckle there. Six of them, different nationalities, all in their best uniforms. No weapons but the shafts of pennons. An aged Chinese gentleman, no, a Buddhist communicator dressed to look like a Chinese, wearing a silk robe with designs on it and a small cap, was taking position at the head of the honor guard. Of course, somebody who spoke Cyclo to greet the arrivals, yet who looked like a dignitary. It would be 3 or 4 minutes until the first one appeared, and Johnny walked toward the ops room. He didn't get in. The boy, Kwong, sprinted out, going somewhere fast, and Sir Robert popped out of the door and called after him. "And tell Stormalong to bring that other recognition book, too." The boy hardly checked his pace, nodding in full run. Beyond Sir Robert, the ops room was boiling with sound and movement as people worked. Johnny opened his mouth to ask how it was going, but Sir Robert answered before he could speak. Sir Robert shook his head bleakly. "They're using a new kind of bomb. The guns sometimes don't explode it, and the idiots are burning deserted cities. Our drones are still running. Why would they want to burn an empty place that used to be called San Francisco? The last drone shot we had of it, there were just 2 bears walking down the street. We're dealing with daft imbeciles." Johnny made to go in past him, and Sir Robert shook his head again. "You can't do anything more than we're doing. Have you thought what we're going to tell these emissaries?"
"No idea," said Johnny. "Shouldn't we get Clan Chief Fergus down here?"
"No, no," said Sir Robert. "No, in a wee chance. Edinburgh is gang up in flames."
Johnny felt a contraction of his heart.
"Any news of Chrissy?"
"They'd all be doon in the shelters. Dunnel Dean has given them all the air cover he can."
Stormalong raced in with the book. Sir Robert took a look at Johnny.
"Go get yourself cleaned up, and think of something to tell these arrivals."
He shooed Johnny off toward his room and vanished into ops. He closed the door behind him so the frantic sounds wouldn't come into the platform area. Johnny walked on toward his room. Just as he was about to duck into the passage, the humming of the wires, which had been going on underneath the music, made itself known by stopping. There was a space of time and then a slight recoil. The Hockner emissary was on the platform. Noseless, holding a monocle on a stick, he was dressed in shimmering robes. He had a gold-colored hamper beside him. A bell on the screen pinged. The screen top edge lit with a purple glow all around. The Hockner picked up the hamper, looked about through his monocle, and minced off the platform. The honor guard saluted and dipped pennons. He halted well clear of the disease control fence. A messenger took the hamper from him. The Buddhist in Chinese clothes bowed. In a supercilious tone of voice, the Hockner emissary said in Cyclo,
"I am Blan Jetso, extraordinary minister plenipotentiary of the Emperor of the Hockners, long may he reign. I am empowered to negotiate and arrange final and binding amendments to agreements or treaties in all things political or military. My person is inviolate, and any molestation cancels any agreements. Any effort to hold me hostage shall be in vain, for I shall not be redeemed by my government. At the threat of any torture or extortion, you are warned that I shall commit suicide instantly in ways unknown to you. I am not the carrier of any disease nor weapon. Long live the Hockner Empire! And how are you today?"
The communicator dressed as a Chinese bowed and made a brief, fast speech of welcome, very pat, told him the conference would begin in about 3 hours, and led him off to a private apartment where he could rest or refresh himself. Johnny had an idea these arrivals would all be about the same, different only as to races, persons, and clothes. He was trying to think of something to tell the emissaries. It was a bit of a shock for Sir Robert to infer that it was up to him. When that grizzled old veteran didn't have any ideas, But then, he must be terribly distressed over Edinburgh. So was Johnny. 5. Johnny ducked under the door beam to enter the passage to his room, and a wave of dizziness hit him. So far, in trying to handle the dam, he had carried himself along on willpower, and he had pushed the feeling aside. But now, with worry about Edinburgh and Chrissy, he felt he was not in very good condition to handle much of anything. He had taken quite a battering these last couple of days. He was not prepared for what he found in the passage just outside his room. There were 4 people there, and they were working on things he couldn't quite make out. They had low benches, they were sitting on the floor, their heads were down, and their hands were flying. Mr. Tsung sensed his presence and bobbed up from the floor. He bowed.
"Lord Johnny, meet my wife."
The second person, a gray-haired Chinese woman with a kindly face, bobbed up, smiled, bowed. Johnny bowed. It made his head feel bad. The woman popped down and went right back to work.
"Meet my daughter," said Mr. Tsung.
The third person bobbed up, bowed. The daughter was a very beautiful Chinese girl, very delicate. She wore a flower in her hair. Johnny bowed. It made his head feel worse. The girl sat down and went frantically back to work.
"Meet my son-in-law," said Mr. Tsung.
A good-looking Chinese bobbed up from his bench with a clatter. He bowed. He was in the blue work uniform the mechanics wore. Johnny bowed very slightly so the room wouldn't spin. The young man popped down and sparks again flew from his tools. Johnny looked at them. They were working dedicatedly and with near ferocity on whatever they were doing. Johnny felt a pang of sorrow. If this conference failed, and if they lost, what suffering would await these decent people? These and the rest of the 35,000 that were all that remained of the human race. He could not face the prospect of letting them down. He went into his room. Somebody else had used those 2 hours. Angus, probably, and an electrician. A rack with 3 view screens now stood against the wall beyond the foot of his bed. A button camera had been placed in the ops room for 1 screen, and he could see the huddled groups there, faces strained as they handled microphones and drone pictures and the operations board. Another button camera was trained on the conference room to broadcast to the 2nd screen. The conference room was empty. The 3rd button camera was on the platform and console and served the 3rd screen. Even as he looked, the Tallnep emissary arrived. He was in shimmering green. Even his cap was green. But he had on dirty blue boots. Huge glasses hid his eyes. He carried a sort of scepter with a large knob at the top and a green hamper on green wheels for his food and supplies. A reptilian creature, although he walked upright and had a face and arms and legs. A genetic line from dinosaurs that had become miniature and sentient. He made his speech much like the Hockner, accepted the reply with an evil smile, folded his shimmering green cloak about his steel-hard body, and was led away to a private apartment. He looked like trouble. Johnny was about to throw himself down on the bed when he suddenly obstructed. Mr. Tsung had followed him in.
"No, no," said Mr. Tsung. "Bath."
2 Chinese had followed Mr. Tsung in. They had a steaming bath sitting on a mine dolly, which they pushed to an empty spot on the floor before vanishing. "I happen to be just about exhausted," said Johnny in protest. "I will just wash my face." Mr. Tsung slid around in front of him with a mirror.
"Look,"
demanded Mr. Tsung. Johnny looked. Mud. Explosive stains. The black silk sling he had been wearing was a tatter of light tan. Silt was all through his beard and hair. He looked down and saw that somewhere he must have walked up to his waist in ooze. He looked down at his hands, and he could not even tell the color of his skin. He looked like something no dog would have dragged out of the village garbage dump. "You win," said Johnny, and wearily began to get out of his clothes. Mr. Tsung had a big mine bucket, and as each garment was removed, he dropped it with some distaste in the bucket, even the helmet and boots and guns. Johnny climbed into the bath. It was not long enough to stretch out his legs, but the water came up to his chest. He had never had a hot bath before, only rivers and cold mountain streams. He felt the exhaustion oozing out of him. Indeed, he found with some surprise, there was much you could say in favor of hot baths. Avoiding the bandage on one arm, Mr. Tsung scrubbed industriously with a lathering soap and a brush. Suddenly, he stopped work and there was a whispered consultation back of Johnny. Then a touch on the top of each of Johnny's shoulders. Another consultation, and one of Johnny's arms was held out by Mr. Tsung, and a piece of string was stretched down the length of it. Johnny was momentarily horrified to realize the daughter was behind him, and he was naked in the tub. He turned his head, but the daughter was gone. Mr. Tsung scrubbed on. He washed Johnny's hair and beard. Twice more the bath was stopped, once to put a string around his chest, the second time to put a string down the side of his leg. Eventually, Mr. Tsung dried his hair and beard with a towel and then wrapped a bigger one around Johnny as he stepped out of the tub. He dried Johnny off, having to jump up a bit to really get the shoulders now that Johnny was standing. He put Johnny in a soft blue robe and only then permitted him to lie down on the bed. Thankful to stretch out at last, avoiding even looking at the screens, Johnny was interrupted again. It was Dr. McKendrick and Dr. Allen. The robe was loose and they got his arm out. Dr. Allen cut off the bandage, cleaned the area with alcohol that stung the nose, probably whiskey of not too good a distillation, poured some white powder in the wound, and then made him eat some of it. More sulfur. Mr. Tsung was there with a bowl of soup while Dr. Allen put on a fresh bandage. Then the two doctors stood back. Johnny, wise in such medical manners, began to suspect they were up to something. They had that false joviality doctors assume just before they take you by surprise and do something gruesome.
"I always thought," said Dr. Allen, "that Donald Dean and Stormalong were wild. But I was out there when you blew that cliff in. You are the wild one, Johnny Tyler. Do you always use a battle plane to light fuses?"
Johnny was about to inform him somewhat austerely that there had been no time at all to rig fuses when Dr. McKendrick moved closer.
"I suppose," said Dr. McKendrick, "it just seemed more natural to him,"
a remark calculated to distract. And he took the long needle he had been holding behind him and, seizing Johnny's wrist, slid 2 inches of steel into a vein and pumped a full syringe of something into Johnny's blood.
"Ow!" said Johnny. "That wasn't fair! You know I don't like your needles."
The stuff burned like fire in his vein.
"That's for your dizziness," said Dr. McKendrick, smugly cleaning the needle. "It's some stuff we found called B-complex. The venom and the relaxant and the sulfur all rob the system of it. You'll feel much better very shortly."
"I've got enough to do," said Johnny, a bit cross, "without being shot full of holes."
Dr. Allen laid a hand on his shoulder.
"That's just it," he said. "You've got far, far too much to worry about and to do. You've got to learn to let others help you. Let them contribute as well. You do splendidly. Let others help, too."
He gave Johnny a pat on the shoulder and they left. The soup had made his stomach feel better. After a bit, he raised his head and bobbed it. He wasn't as dizzy as he had been. Another couple of emissaries had arrived on the platform. The ops room looked frantic. He was worried about this coming conference. Johnny thought he had lain around long enough. "Tsung," he called, "please get out my best buckskin suit." Yes, he would let someone else contribute. Mr. Tsung could dig up his buckskins. The result was totally unexpected. Mr. Tsung flashed in, drew himself up to his full 5 feet, and said,
"No!"
Then he struggled to find more words from his meager store of English.
"They lords!"
He couldn't say what he wanted to say. An amazed Johnny saw Mr. Tsung tear out of the room and come back in a moment with a coordinator for the Chinese, one who spoke Mandarin. Mr. Tsung was blazing away at the coordinator with every shot in his magazine. Mr. Tsung died down. The coordinator opened his mouth to speak. Mr. Tsung thought of something else, battered the coordinator with it,
and only then stood back with a "so there" expression and put his hands in his sleeves and bowed. The coordinator, a black-bearded Scot, took a deep breath.
"You're maybe not going to like this, McTyler, but you've gotten yourself a diplomatic manager. I know these Chinese, and when they get their mind set on something, they're worse than my old woman."
Johnny had lain back. He addressed the ceiling. "And what is wrong with my simply asking for my best buckskin suit to be laid out?"
"Everything," said the coordinator. "Just everything."
He sighed and began to explain.
"Mr. Tsung is a descendant of a family that served as chamberlains to the Qing Dynasty, those who ruled China from the Mandate 1644 AD to about 1911, maybe 1100 years ago. That was the last dynasty before China became a People's Republic. The court and emperors were not Chinese. They were a race called Manchus, and they needed a lot of advice. Tsung says his family served them well, but times changed, and because they had served the Manchus, his ancestors were exiled to Tibet. It was the Western powers that overthrew the Manchus, Tsung says, not his family's advice. So Mr. Tsung here is really a Mandarin of the Blue Button, according to ancestry, a lord of the court. He says all the family records and scrolls are with the Chinese university library you put in a vault someplace."
"Russia," said Johnny. "They're in the Russian base, though Lord knows how it's holding out right now."
"Well, good," said the Scot. "He says he could read you some of it, but he doesn't have it here. But his family always kept up on its background, expecting some day a dynasty they could serve would come back into power. They have long memories, these Chinese. Imagine waiting 1100 years to get back a job."
Mr. Tsung detected this was wandering off track, and he nudged the coordinator's arm and made gestures that clearly said, "Tell him, tell him." The coordinator sighed. He was not sure how Johnny would take this.
"He says you are Lord Johnny, and,"
he got it all out in a rush,
"you can't go around looking like a barbarian."
If Johnny had not been so worried about other things, he would have laughed. The coordinator was relieved that this had not been received as criticism. He continued.
"He says he knew there would be a diplomatic conference, and that a lot of lords would be arriving, and that they would be very uppish and snobbish and fancy. And it's true enough. I've seen them coming in on the platform. Jeweled breathe masks, glittering cloth, ornaments. One even had a jeweled monocle. Pretty fancy dudes."
He then swallowed and said the rest in a rush.
"And if you go out there and talk to them in hides, they'll think you're just a barbarian and won't listen to you. He says if you look and act,"
he swallowed again,
"like an uncouth savage, they'll hold you in contempt."
He stopped, relieved to have gotten through it.
"And that's what he was trying to tell you. Don't be upset with him. I could add that quite in addition to a genuine affection for you, about 35,000 lives. No, less than that now, but a lot depend on this conference. Otherwise, I wouldn't have translated it for him, because to me, McTyler, you're no barbarian."
Johnny thought all he would have to do was reassure Mr. Tsung he would be polite and not slap anybody, and that would be that. But not so. Mr. Tsung made the coordinator stand right there and translate everything he said exactly with no changes. Mr. Tsung hunkered down close to the side of the bed and started talking. The coordinator translated at each pause.
"It is one thing," translated the Scot, "to be a mighty warrior. But although you have won every battle and driven the enemy to rout, from a field of slaughter, the entire war can be lost at the conference table."
Johnny digested that. They actually hadn't won the war yet by a long ways, but even if they did, they could lose the whole thing in that conference room. He had known that, but he was impressed. Mr. Tsung had obviously sought this job not as somebody who cleaned up a room, but as an advisor. Well, heavens knew he needed advice. He had come up with no ideas. "Your attitude," the coordinator continued to translate as the little Mr. Tsung spoke on,
"must be calculated to impress. A lord is used to handling inferiors. He is impressed by being handled as an inferior. Be haughty. Do not be polite.
be cold and disdainful, be distant and aloof? Say, this old man is really ringing out my Mandarin. That's real caught Chinese he's talking.
Mr. Tsung motioned him not to add his own comments.
Do not, the Scot obediently translated, agree or seem to agree to anything. Your words can be tricked into seeming to agree, so avoid the word yes. They will make preposterous demands they know they cannot attain, just to gain bargaining points. So you, in return, should advance to them impossible demands, even if you feel they won't agree. And who knows, you might win them. All diplomacy is a matter of compromise. There is a middle ground between the two opposite poles of impossible demands, which will become the eventual treaty or agreement. Always work for the most advantageous position you can get.
The Scot paused.
He wants to know if you've got all that.
Yes, sir, said Johnny, and welcome. He was feeling this was useful, even though it didn't give him the idea he needed.
And now, said the coordinator, he wants to give you a lesson in deportment. Watch him.
Well, they were dealing with creatures from many another race, and their ideas of deportment and those from ancient imperial China might not agree at all. So Johnny felt a bit tolerant as he watched the Chinese. But almost immediately, he felt he was wrong. These manners fitted any race. How to stand, feet apart, tall, leaning slightly back, firmly fixed to the earth, position dominant. Got that? Then do it. How to hold a scepter or wand, one hand on grip end, other end laid in the other palm. Grip both ends to show control. Tap one end into palm to hint the small possibility of punishment when one might wish to seem a bit offended. Wave idly in air to show that the other's argument was of no consequence and was like the wind. Got that? Here is a wand. Do it. Not quite right. Be easy, lordly. Now do them all again. Walk as though not caring what lies before you. Suggest power. Steady, unstoppable. Like this. Got it? Do it. For half an hour, Mr. Tsung worked on Johnny. And Johnny realized that his own walk was like that of a panther, whereas for this conference it must be stately. Mr. Tsung made him go through the whole lesson, and then the postures and walks again before he was satisfied. Johnny, who had always had a sinking feeling about being a diplomat, began to feel a bit more confident. There was an art to this thing. It was like hunting game, but a different kind of game. It was like a battle, but a different kind of battle. He thought he was all through. He could see on the screen that more and more emissaries were arriving. But Mr. Tsung said they would all have to present their credentials at the first meeting in the conference room, and that there was lots and lots of time. Had Johnny thought of a strategy? A strategy was very necessary. How to approach the diplomatic battle? What one intended to use to maneuver? Well, Johnny could think about it. It was like a battle, but your infantry and cavalry were ideas and words. Maneuvered wrongly, it meant defeat. Meanwhile, they had to handle this other matter, and leaving Johnny a bit mystified, Mr. Tsung went out in the hall. Seeing that for a moment Johnny wasn't busy, Chief Chong Wan slid in the door. He was beaming and bobbing his head.
That damn?
He had made a tight grip with both fists and gestured with his hands.
The hole. The outflow is decreasing. The level of the lake is rising.
He bobbed his head vigorously, bowed deeply, and vanished. Johnny thought, well, that was one thing that had gone right. The power wouldn't go off and leave some diplomat parked in some wrong space. All he had to worry about now was a burning planet, the fate of its people, and this conference. That shot had worked. He wasn't dizzy. 6. The other matter turned out to be a haircut. The daughter came in and sat him in a chair facing the view screens and got to work with a small pair of scissors and a comb. The idea was rather novel to Johnny. He usually just hacked his hair off with a knife when it got too long. She seemed to be very practiced and expert and no doubt took care of the tonsorial requirements of many, for she just sailed in with her scissors moving so fast they sounded like an oar belt running at high speed. Clip, clip, clip.
So diplomacy was like a battle, Johnny was thinking. Watching these lords arrive, one could see that they practically oozed authority and power. The visitors attacking Earth were almost local small fry, controlling at the most a few dozen planets. Some of those arriving, he knew from earlier readings, were from other universes and controlled hundreds of planets in just one governmental sphere. And they were very arrogant, very sure of themselves. Whatever their physical form, there was no doubt that they were ministers plenipotentiary to powerful heads of state. What wealth and striking power they represented. Behind them were collective populations numbering trillions in just one state alone. They were the veterans and victors of hundreds of such conferences. Yes, a conference was a battle, and an even more important one than a war. And what chance did he and Sir Robert have against these experienced diplomats? They were both warriors, not glib, smooth, cunning courtiers with 1,000 parliamentary tricks up their sleeves. With no guns or battalions, but with only his wits and the tips Mr. Tsung had given him, he felt quite outnumbered, and so far he had no strategy at all. The girl had a small mirror she was holding up so he could see. She had cut his hair to collar height and back, and combed and rolled it at the bottom. It looked kind of like a helmet he had seen with a back neck guard, and the hair was shiny. His beard and mustache looked very precise, much shorter. He hardly knew himself. Had she seen some old paintings of men with beards and mustaches cut like this? Indeed she had. There was an ancient man book, English, open on the bed to a picture of somebody named Sir Francis Drake that had defeated somebody called the Spaniards long, long ago. His attention was attracted by something, and he took the mirror from her. His neck. The scars had been quite faint, for they were really calluses, and they were gone. He had to look very hard to see the remains of the Brigante grenade scar on his cheek. That would probably vanish, too. Somehow he felt freed with the collar scars gone. He understood the irony of it, and would have smiled, but his attention was pulled to the ops room screen. The sound relay had been off, and he gave the girl back the mirror and hit the button. "Can't think what they're up to," Stormalong was saying, as he angrily finished pulling another picture out of the drone resolver. "I've lost count." 15, said somebody else. "Look at this. A spray of firebombs going down into this deserted..." He looked at the map. "Detroit. Why set Detroit on fire? There's been nobody in Detroit for over 1,000 years. Are they trying to pull defenses over to that continent? They're insane." He threw the picture down. "I'm not providing any air cover for a bunch of ruins. What's the latest from Edinburgh?" "Anti-aircraft still replying," said someone at the ops board. "Smoke interfering with visual firing? Donald Dean just shot down his 16th Horven strafing plane?" Johnny touched the button to sound off. He felt an impatience taking hold of him. These diplomats coming in one by one, it was too slow. The coordinator had come in with Mr. Tsung, who was holding a lot of things in his arms. It was obvious that Johnny was under strain. Mr. Tsung said something in his sing-song voice. The coordinator said, "Mr. Tsung reminds you that even a lost battle can be redeemed at a conference table. To be patient and use skill." Mr. Tsung had other things now. He took the haircut cloth off Johnny and showed him a tunic. It was a very plain garment at first glance. It was cut from shimmering black silk. It had a stand-up collar. It was supposed to be a tight form fit, but it was the silver-colored buttons that attracted Johnny's attention. He knew what they were. He had once remarked to Kerr that it was surprising to see such pretty metal on a cyclo emergency switch. It looked like silver at first glance, but the least amount of light striking it made it glow in rainbow colors. Kerr had said, no, it wasn't used for emergency switches because it was pretty. It was used because it was hard. It was a one-molecule-thick metal spray of an iridium alloy, and no matter how many claw points hit it, it wouldn't wear off. And when you were in a dark mine, with little light, the emergency button was visible because it looked like it flashed in colors. He knew what the son-in-law had been doing, plating buttons, enough to blind you. Mr. Tsung had him put it and the black silk pants on and button the tunic all up. Iridium buttons every couple of inches down the front. Then Mr. Tsung made him put on a pair of boots. They were chinko boots, but they had plated them with iridium alloy. A belt was fastened around him, a wide one, and it was also plated, all except the buckle. And that was his old gold-colored U.S. Air Force buckle, shined until it gleamed. He remembered thinking once, in the cage, he might be the last surviving member of a long-gone force. A strange thing to think, but right now it sort of cheered him up. He had thought he was getting dressed and was a bit dismayed to find that Mr. Tsung did not like a pucker on the shoulder and a certain gather in the tunic back and took it all off him and sent them back. Mr. Tsung had something else now. It was his twisted knob carry with the carved figures. But they had plated it with iridium. It flashed like a length of flame. He knew he couldn't use it that way, but he was glad not to be going into that conference totally without a weapon. Then the son-in-law came in. He was carrying a helmet. Basically, it was just a Russian helmet they had smoothed down. But what had they done to it? The chin strap was plated with iridium alloy. So was the whole helmet. But what was this? The son-in-law turned it, a bit proudly, so Johnny could see what was on the front. How had they done this? Then he saw that the son-in-law was holding the paper patterns he had laid down on the helmet front and sides, one after the other, and sprayed through the open holes with different metal sprays. It was a dragon. And what a dragon! Gold wings on the side of the helmet, clawed paws that seemed to grip the lower helmet edge, scales and spikes from the spine edged in blue, a ferocious face with what appeared to be real rubies for flaming eyes, white fangs and a scarlet mouth. Ferocious. And a round, whitish ball in its scarlet, otherwise gaping mouth. It looked three-dimensional. It was similar to the dragon at the console and the clay dragons lying on the building pile, except for this big white ball in its mouth. At first, Johnny felt it was far too fancy. And just then another emissary arrived on the platform, wearing a towering gold crown. This was far less fancy than that, but still. Johnny looked at it. It was a bit different from the other dragons. "Very beautiful," said Johnny, so the coordinator could tell the son-in-law. They were fixing his clothes. It wasn't time yet by a long way. Johnny looked at the helmet. Via the coordinator, he said to Mr. Tsung, "Tell me about this dragon." Mr. Tsung tossed it off, and via the coordinator told Johnny that the throne of China had been called the Dragon Throne. Lung Pao, or Chai Fu, patterns or robes were court dress. It was an imperial. Johnny knew all that. "Tell him to tell me about this dragon. It's different." Mr. Tsung sighed. There were a lot of other things, far more important, that he should be telling Lord Johnny, and he didn't think it was very applicable just now to embark on myths and fairy tales. But, well, yes, this dragon was different. The whole story? Oh, my. Well, it went this way. Once upon a time. Johnny lay back on the bed with the helmet on his stomach and listened. Unfortunately, he did have time. So he listened as Mr. Tsung went on telling him the long and involved fairy tale. Suddenly, about halfway through it, Johnny abruptly sat up and said to the coordinator, "I thought so. Please, send for Sir Robert." It startled Mr. Tsung, and Johnny said, "Thank you. Very good story. Thank you more than you know." As Lord Johnny seemed pleased and things were a bit rushed, Mr. Tsung happily went out to make sure the silk suit was altered correctly. Johnny looked around to see whether there were any button cameras in the place. He couldn't really tell. He didn't think so, but he would be very brief and cryptic to play it on the safe side. A couple minutes later, Sir Robert came in. He, too, had been grooming himself. He was wearing a cloak with the Royal Stuart colors, a matching kilt, and Scottish white spats. The wool was made of shining hairs. He was the complete Scottish soldier and lord, excepting only weapons. Johnny had never seen him dressed in full regimentals before. Quite impressive. But the old man looked a bit hollow-eyed and worried. "This is going to be a tough one," said Johnny.
"Aye, lad. Did you ken that tall nip? I be no diplomat, laddie, and there's nae choice.